are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, September 12th, 2019. I'm Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Daniel Bessner, historian from the University of Washington, on the fog of intervention, Samantha Power, and her dangerous, reckless interventionist foreign policy. If it's not Bernie, she is angling pretty hard to be Secretary of State if there's another Democratic administration. We'll get into the details and the flaws in the power worldview. The Supreme Court says that Trump's administration can begin denying basic rights to migrants, denying basic asylum to migrants while a legal fight continues. In another edition of Judicial Nominees Have Consequences, Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu says, vote for me or the Arabs will annihilate you. Even as mass suppression continues in Kashmir and in West Papua in Indonesia, the maker of OxyContin reportedly pays billions of dollars to settle an opioid lawsuit. Israeli elections, as I said, are underway. Will Netanyahu return to power, or will Jeffrey Epstein associate Ehud Barak lead a centrist coalition? Meet Charlie Kupperman. He's Trump's new acting national security advisor. And, of course, he advised a group that promoted anti-Muslim conspiracy theories. Remember the despicable, disgusting Trump administration decision to deny people fleeing from the Bahamas getting on boats to the United States? Well, a 12-year-old Bahamian girl separated from her parents ends up in a Miami home for migrant kids. ICE is building a state-of-the-art warfare training facility that will include hyper-realistic simulations of homes in Chicago and Arizona. The reason why we know this is because someone from ICE accidentally released it, proving once again that ICE really is the effing moron fascist organization. New revelations in Lava Jato. Not only did Judge Sergio Moro, clown fascist Bolsonaro's justice minister who corruptly put President Da Silva in jail and made him a political prisoner, he didn't only illegally leak conversations, he edited them to make Lula look bad. North Carolina Republicans vote to override a budget veto in a half-empty assembly during a 9/11 remembrance. Maybe not a moment for nation-state rituals, huh, guys? Education Department threatens to suspend employees who provide the Post with budget data. And girls appear to be 11 and 12, seen with Jeffrey Epstein getting off his plane in 2018, authorities say. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. But first, let's just start. Oh, of course, also September 11th was yesterday. That's also the anniversary of the CIA-backed 1973 coup, which deposed Salvador Allende and brought Augusto Pinochet to power and resulted in the loss of, I mean, tens of thousands of people in Chile, but also if you look at the Condor years, which was the coordinated efforts of Latin American fascist governments, Argentina, Chile, and so on, with the strong backing of the CIA and Henry Kissinger, you're talking about a global mass killing spree in the late 70s through the early 80s. And then, of course, going to the 80s, where the Reagan administration's dirty wars and support of genocide in places like Guatemala. We'll get to maybe some of that in the fun half. It's going to be a very short show today because we have to be here tonight At around, I think our coverage is probably starting around 7:45 or so.
Hello.
Hello. And we're...
Good morning, Patriots.
I still cannot get over the fact that
Good morning, Rebels.
That Dennis Prager is saying that to Dave Rubin's face. That the whole thing that drop comes from is Dennis Prager basically looking at Dave Rubin and saying, oh, thank you, you stupid idiot, for being a gay guy that repeats all of our far-right talking points. And by the way, we're not homophobic. Hello.
Hello.
Dennis Prager did accomplish one thing in his life, and that was that video. That was very funny. But we're doing live coverage of the debate tonight. We're working a double, so we'll probably be out of here at about 1:45 today, but we will get to some stuff in the fun half. But we want to start with a little bit of fun. Here's Donald Trump. This is, of course, a country where most people, all Republicans, most Democrats say that we could certainly not get rid of, pollutants in the atmosphere. We can't give everybody single-payer health care. We can't get rid of guns and all sorts of predator companies, but we can do this. The vapes are coming for you. And they're also coming for somebody's kid. It's maybe an interesting tip-off.
It's a bit unclear whose.
Yeah, I don't know what kid we're talking about here, but it's a concern about children.
Your announcement today, are you concerned that the companies that were making these products will be treated unfairly by taking these products off the market?
Well, they've become very rich companies very fast, and the whole thing with vaping is been very profitable. And I want companies. Look, you know that I fight for our companies very hard. I fight. That's why I'm fighting with China. That's why I'm fighting with other countries. If you look at European Union, and if you look at Japan, and if you look at so many others, including South Korea and many others, we're constantly dealing with them to make it good for our companies, because I view it as jobs. I view it as income for our country and jobs. Vaping has become a very big business, as I understand it, like a giant business in a very short period of time. But we can't allow people to get sick, and we can't have our youth be so affected. And I'm hearing it, and that's how the First Lady got involved. And she's got a son together that is a beautiful young man, and she feels very, very strongly about it. She's seen it.
Maybe we'll take that again.
Yeah, let's take that again. She has a kid. She's... Justin Trudeau impregnated her at the NAFTA renegotiations, and she's very concerned.
I'm hearing it, and that's how the First Lady got involved. And she's got a son together that is a beautiful young man, and she feels very, very strongly about it. She's seen it.
Oh,
we're
my
both
God.
Reading.
It'd be really funny if they were talking about Don Jr.
Wouldn't it be really funny if you could just picture all of the traumatic memories going through Donald Trump's, like, and then I begged her to have an abortion months before the baby was born. And then I took her out to dinner at CERT, and I begged again. And then I even let her try Mama Fuca, where they don't even have steak. And I begged her again. Still wouldn't abort the son we
got involved. And she's got a son together that is a beautiful young man, and she feels very, very strongly about it. She's seen it. We're both reading it. A lot of people are reading it. But people are dying with vaping. So we're looking at it very closely. And, you know, if nothing else, this is a conference that's going to let people know about it, because people are going to watch what we're saying.
Right.
And parents are going to be a lot tougher with respect to their children. Right. A lot of people think vaping is wonderful. It's great. It's really not wonderful. That's one thing I think we can say definitely, Commissioner. It's not a wonderful thing. It's got big problems. We have to find out the extent of the problem. It's so new. It's so new. But we're going to find out. And I hope that parents that, they have children and the children are a certain age, I hope they're going to be able to make wise decisions, maybe based on what we're saying today.
You know, it is true. They haven't really been researched. And I think these companies make a lot of claims that are definitely not validated. But
wow.
That's one of those ones where it's like he's not exactly wrong. I mean,
no.
if we wanted to be like some twerps at the Washington Post and fact check it, I mean, Melania does have a kid or
together.
Something together. Yeah, that all
she's got
that
a kid
clears
together
out.
With me.
I wouldn't say that vaping is wonderful or a tremendous thing to do, and it hasn't been researched.
Fair enough.
As if the entire socialist left were not already united against Trump, now he's coming for our nicotine. No. Not going to fly.
She's got a kid. Kid's a little weird. Not sure what.
A lot of people say it's wonderful. It's not.
Not wonderful. A lot of people say it's wonderful.
Grover Norquist won't shut up about it.
Grover Norquist won't keep his goddamn mouth shut. In this golden age of television and podcasts, we all know the value of a truly compelling narrative. Cue Hunt a Killer, the murder mystery box that immerses you in an ongoing experience. With every delivery or episode, you'll dive deeper into what it's like to be a detective, sifting through piles of documents, evidence, and case files until you crack the case. And instead of staring at a screen, you can build an investigation board with friends or an online community, helping each other through every challenge. Plus, part of the proceeds for every box goes to the Cold Case Foundation to help fund cold case investigations. Now, as everybody knows, Sam has commandeered the Hunt a Killer box so he can play it with his kids. He raves about it. He talks about how it's unparalleled family time, how it's a really fun thing to do, and it's a break from the screens while keeping everybody excited and engaged. Right now, just for our listeners, you can go to huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off of your first box. They only accept 200 members per day, so hurry up to take advantage of this offer. That's huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off of your first box. huntakiller.com/majority. We'll be right back with Daniel Bessner.
Perhaps I could have poked or prodded in another way, but I felt trying to figure out why he thinks as he does is what my job is.
Back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Daniel Bessner. He's the Pyle Professor of American Foreign Policy at the Scoop Jackson School at the University of Washington. I can never get over the irony of that appointment, although it is well-deserved, of course. And he's the author of this new piece in The New Republic, The Fog of Intervention, which focuses on the highly troubling record and intellectual framework of Samantha Power, who... Daniel, would you say, with the exception of Sanders, who's sort of the only one attempting to cultivate a bit of a new foreign policy, a significant new foreign policy framework, that this is somebody that could actually be, that will certainly be lobbying to be Secretary of State in a Joe Biden administration, as an example?
Oh, absolutely. I would say there's a very good shot she would be Secretary of State in the Biden administration, or perhaps even a Warren administration. And if not Secretary of State, then definitely one of the most important undersecretaries of state, or at the Department of Defense, too, an undersecretary at the Department of Defense I could see as well.
So who is Samantha Power, and what is her trajectory?
Sure. So just in very brief, Samantha Power is someone who immigrated from Ireland to the United States with her mother, who was a doctor when she was about 9 in the late 1970s. She went to Yale as an undergraduate. After graduating from Yale, she became a war reporter in the Bosnia conflict in the mid-1990s, left that conflict, I believe, in 95 to start a position, not a position, but to become a student at Harvard Law School. At Harvard, really dedicated herself to examining the question of when and if the United States should intervene abroad militarily to end human rights abuses, essentially came up with the conclusion that military intervention should always be on the table. This was over the course of the late 1990s. And then she began writing a book that eventually became 2002's A Problem from Hell, America in the Age of Genocide, in which she argued that the United States over the course of the 20th century failed a number of foreign peoples abroad, the Armenians, the Cambodians, the Kurds, and the Rwandans in particular, but other groups as well, of course, the Jews during the Holocaust, even though the United States eventually, you know, liberated some camps in Western Germany. But she wrote this book, A Problem from Hell. It won the 2002 Pulitzer Award, Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction, was used in the cudgel for the debate to invade Iraq, even though Power herself was against the invasion. She eventually meets up with Barack Obama in around 2005, takes a leave from Harvard to work for him for a year. And after Obama wins the Democratic presidential primary campaign, she becomes one of his foreign policy advisors. When he wins the presidency, he appoints her to a position, to two positions on the National Security Council, basically head of human rights. And then in his second term, Obama's second term, 12 to 16, she replaces Susan Rice as the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. And just to conclude, she was very much in favor of the United States intervening in Libya. And after that, she was in favor of the United States doing more to intervene in Syria. Particularly, she just said today on NPR, in fact, and she says essentially in her book that Obama shouldn't have gone to Congress for approval and should have just intervened essentially unilaterally in Syria. And now she's just published a memoir called The Education of an Idealist, and that is what my review was on.
So what is the significance of Bosnia in all of this? Let's go back to the 1990s and juxtapose it between, we have a post-cold, you know, the Soviet Union has collapsed. There's the need inside, you know, the military-industrial complex and the intellectual complex, the defense intellectuals, which you're a historian of, to basically justify still having a global U.S. military presence, still, you know, eating up huge amount of the discretionary budget with military spending and not really sort of reforming the intelligence apparatus. Then there's this sort of triumphalism, obviously. And then there's an understanding that from Bosnia that seems to have kind of filtered and really culminated in Iraq, although it is interesting that she opposed the invasion. I mean, obviously that's to her credit, but it's in her book. And I think it's in a lot of people's perceptions of Bosnia that, I mean, one, that yes, that early on there was a non-intervention, so there was mass slaughter and genocide, but then that also the later Clinton, the NATO bombing of Serbia was basically, you know, easy, right? There was no real cost to it. It achieved a political objective and so on. Not much on civilian casualties in Serbia, not much on sort of problematizing what NATO's role was it relative to how it related to Russia in a post-Cold War environment. What was actually happening in Bosnia, and how did the presuppositions and conclusions coming out of Bosnia filter into her work, and then the sort of catastrophes that would come after, especially even during Bush, but also in this so-called, you know, liberal hawk or liberal interventionist tradition that she exemplifies?
Sure. So I think to really understand it, you need to go back a little bit earlier. So let's just say this is actually what I wrote my first book on, titled Democracy in Exile. If you go back to the 40s, the people who create things like the National Security Council and the Department of Defense and the CIA, their major argument was essentially that once the Soviet Union is defeated, you could basically get rid of all of these institutions and American life could return to normalcy because there wasn't an existential threat. Now, of course, when the Soviet Union collapses over the course of 1989 to 1991, this isn't actually what happens for a variety of institutional reasons and intellectual reasons, mainly that people begin to believe that the United States has the right and duty to govern the world. And this, of course, is a deep strand of American history, going back to the 1630 speech, A City on a Hill, but really beginning in during World War I with Wilsonianism. The idea that the United States will only be safe in the world if every place in the world is a democracy. So you get this idea after the collapse of the Soviet Union that the United States military is essentially able to act as a non-political force in the world. During the Cold War, it wasn't really possible for Samantha Power in the 1960s or 1970s to argue that the U.S. military was an apolitical force because it was clearly fighting anti-communism, right? But with the rise of the post-Cold War rhetoric of the end of history, the idea that all political development had come to an end, you get this argument that the military could be an apolitical force and it could actually act not on behalf of the United States, but on behalf of humanity. And so these are the arguments that are beginning to percolate in the early to mid-1990s. Now, what happens in the mid-1990s are two terrible humanitarian disasters. One, you have Rwanda in 94, the genocide that the United States doesn't intervene to stop. And then you have basically the siege of Sarajevo in the mid-1990s during the Bosnian Civil War as Yugoslavia has broken down. So Samantha Power is basically in the former Yugoslavia in the early and mid, and really more in the mid-1990s, and she witnesses what happens when there's essentially a humanitarian crisis and the United States doesn't intervene to stop it. So this becomes a really crucial moment in her life because for her, the failure of the United States to stop the siege.
Oh, sorry, folks. Call Daniel right back. You know, just give me a touch of just a little bit.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you now. It just dropped. All right, let's just come right back. Do you remember where you were?
Okay, so absolutely. So basically, Power.
Yeah, okay, go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
No worries. So basically, Power is in Bosnia in the mid-1990s, and she basically, her personal experience leads her to conclude that the United States really needs to intervene in the world. Otherwise, humanitarian disasters are going to repeat. And not only that, the United States has the right and duty because at the end of the Cold War, it can act as an apolitical force. And so what eventually happens is Clinton does end the siege of Sarajevo in the summer of 1995. I believe it is July or August. I don't exactly have the date. And this sets the stage going for a bunch of liberal humanitarian interventionist arguments that become very powerful over the course of the mid to late 1990s. Of course, Clinton intervenes in Kosovo with airstrikes, and in the lead up to the invasion of Iraq, not the major reason, but one of the reasons that people were arguing in favor of intervening was that Saddam Hussein's gassing of the Kurds in the 80s, the chemical attacks against the Kurds, provided a casus belli, a legitimate reason to go to war in order to protect humanitarian intervention, in order to basically defend human rights it through humanitarian intervention. And this becomes Power's essentially major argument and a problem from hell. And the book, particularly when it won the Pulitzer in the, you know, the 6 months after 9/11, we just had the anniversary. So in the 6 months after 9/11, she becomes a very influential figure in human rights discourse throughout the United States, but also throughout the world as well.
So how does the tension work? I remember reading that book in college and, you know, there's no room in that book, certainly, for any economic questions, for any, you know, broader kind of equity and social rights questions. There's not much focus on the U.S. role, as an example, in, say, the other 9/11 and supporting a coup that removes Allende on behalf of, you know, U.S. Business interests, essentially, in their region. So that isn't in the book. But attention that is in the book is that on one hand, as you're saying, it's this sort of blind faith in American power to right a particular type of wrong in the world. You know, not the wrong of sweatshops or maldistribution, but the specific, I mean, obviously very serious atrocities of genocide and mass killing. But at the same time, she also has to, you know, document as an example the fact that the Clinton administration did sit on its hands during Rwanda. Not only did they sit on their hands, they actually had to actively try to downplay what was happening in Rwanda because they, fearing basically because of what had happened in Somalia, they saw it as essentially a PR problem, not a human problem. Obviously, she had to acknowledge Kissinger, you know, and his, you know, and leading to an ironic and funny photo we'll get to later. But how did she square that? I didn't really get how she did it in the book, but how did that sort of split come of, as a historian of U.S. foreign policy, you have to see all of the areas where the United States has either, you know, fought to block U.N. conventions on genocide, which she focuses on that book, or sat on its hands, or maybe even she kind of acknowledges to some extent even supported genocidal regimes versus the United States can become – you know, the bombardier wing of Amnesty International.
Exactly. I mean, the biggest critiques of the book from historians is that there's no mention of Vietnam, right, and there's no mention of the United States' participation in the Indonesian genocide, let alone mentions of things like the overthrowing of Mossadegh in Iran or the overthrowing of Arbenz in Guatemala in the 50s and Allende. You know, none of that is mentioned at all in the book. So there's some obvious blind spots. So what I try to do as a historian is try to historicize why power was able to allow herself these blind spots. And to me, it's really this end of history moment plus added with this sort of Holocaust memory that becomes really popular in the 80s and the 90s. There's a crucial moment in Power's memoir, which I haven't really seen talked about in many of the reviews. I talk about a little of mine, but basically as a college student, she visits Dachau, which is one of the first concentration camp. It's outside Munich, and the American forces liberated Dachau. And she says, look, this really began demonstrating to her like the importance of American military power in the world. And if the United States didn't intervene in World War II, then all the Jews of Europe would have died. Of course, there's no mention of the fact that, for example, it was the Red Army that liberated Auschwitz, right? Right. So all told, I think Power's history, like I think many histories of liberal interventionists, by this I mean the histories that they choose to remember, are incredibly selective. And this is, to me, the major problem with their thought, is that they want the good of American military intervention. And I think I'll go on record as saying that if you could stop genocide, you know, theoretically, that would be a good thing. But sure, the problem is in actual history that it never just results in a quick stop of a genocide. It always destabilizes these societies. And beyond that, there's the pernicious effects of having this enormous military, beyond, you know, the fact that the United States is literally able to destroy many areas of the world in 10 minutes, and someone like Donald Trump could do that. There's the fact that we spend so much of our money on weapons instead of welfare. There's the fact that we have a domestic political culture that is organized around military ideas and military metaphors. So the problem that people like Power are never able to confront is that it is not historically possible in actual history to get the quote-unquote good of military intervention without the bad. And I think this, you see this primarily in the fact that they always pose military intervention as a philosophical problem, right? Do you save dying babies? The answer, of course, is yes. But the problem is when you're talking about foreign policy decision making, when you're talking about what has actually happened in 70 years of the United States running the world, it's never just about saving innocent babies. It winds up that military intervention kills more babies in the medium and long run than perhaps not doing anything at all. But the problem is that after the end of the Cold War, and then I'll finish up,
no, please,
is at the end of the Cold War, people really believed that the United States had won history and was able to do whatever it wanted in the world. And you see this with Madeleine Albright calling the nation the indispensable nation, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. And even in the Albright case, though, what's extraordinary, I mean, those of us who kind of came up on the, you know, the left, will remember that even as that discourse is happening, Madeleine Albright is confronted on a, you know, mainstream American news program. I don't recall exactly which one, and basically saying, look, the sanctions regime that you're overseeing in Iraq is people are dying as a result of lack of resources. And she said, she didn't say, you know, it was a sort of typical evasion, which was to sort of pin all of it on Saddam Hussein. Obviously, part of it was the Hussein regime. But the reality was there was very aggressive sanctions that were blocking medicines and other vital, you know, economic activity in Iraq. She said it's a price worth paying. And nobody seemed to kind of say, wait a second, how do those two things fit here?
Or who allowed Madeleine Albright or any U.S. policymaker to be the moral arbiter of the world?
Right.
It's a prerogative and a privilege of empire, because another reason that people like Samantha Power and Madeleine Albright want to intervene abroad is because the other countries aren't going to intervene back. Right. So all of this is premised on a prerogative of unquestioned American empire. And they basically, what happened in the 90s is that they equated the empire with literally the moral good. And I'm using philosophical terms because that is what they literally thought, that the United States and morality were literally identical. And you see very quickly with the problems that this could lead to.
Right. And so then let's contrast, and maybe even as a point of reference, the trajectories of Peter Beinart, who used to edit the, you know, very hard neocon, neoliberal line in the New Republic, where he, you know, quite happily promoted the invasion of Iraq and, you know, various aggressive policies from Israel and the United States. And then as a journalist and as an analyst has sort of significantly modified his foreign policy view because of actual realities on the ground. And then Samantha Power, who actually ends up in power in a position to, quote, do something, in her words, and basically helps oversee some of the largest foreign policy disasters that the Obama administration was involved in. And also in the same context of an administration which is, you know, radically amping up a global drone regime. What does that tell you, you know, that even that contrast between maybe an outsider and insider, but also the fact that apparently there's been no lessons here. There's been no evolution of thinking.
Right. And that's why my first zinger in the review is for a book titled The Education of an Idealist. Power appears to not have learned very much. And I think you see it in the fact that, for example, throughout the book, Power doesn't mention Israeli occupation of the West Bank or the Israeli siege of Gaza once. She doesn't mention. Right. She doesn't mention Saudi Arabia or the various human rights abuses it regularly commits once. She doesn't mention drone strikes once. Whereas Beinart, for example, and to his great credit, has actually spent the time to learn from history, and I think has immersed himself more seriously in American history, and perhaps more importantly, has done things like gone to the West Bank and actually see what Israeli occupation is like on the ground, and has admirably changed his mind as a result of that. And this is so the question is, what's the difference? And I think a big difference between them is the fact that Power, I couldn't really get it, it was cut from my review, but she really believes in meritocracy. Right. And there's a lot of talk, and it hasn't really been getting much discussion in the reviews because everyone's focusing on the humanitarian stuff. But basically, there's a lot of lean-in feminism throughout The Education of an Idealist. There's one chapter titled Lean On, where she talks about how she needs to lean on like Kat Sunstein, her husband, the famous nudger in chief, and things like that. And so she really accepts the premises of neoliberal capitalist empire and globalization fundamentally. And I think to reject those premises would be to reject the project to which she dedicated her life. And I mean, I'm a historian. I don't like to get psychological, but I just imagine that would be difficult for most people to do. But it's especially difficult for Power because, you know, it's not in some real sense, she has blood on her hands by basically promoting Libyan intervention and by basically saying that Obama should have ignored Congress and intervened more heavily in Syria. So I think someone like Power is unable to basically turn against the premises by which she's lived her life in a way that Beinart, who's not a policymaker, is much more able to do. But the question to me that's interesting is to see what the Democratic foreign policy establishment is going to take from this going forward. And if Power is going to be someone who's a viable candidate for a senior level position in a Warren administration, or maybe even in a Sanders administration, because you and I have talked about who's going to staff these agencies. So it'll be interesting to see going forward what the Democratic foreign policy establishment does with Samantha Power and her career.
Let's spell out Libya and Syria a little bit more. I want to quote specifically, though, from your piece. Power's recollection of the Syria debate highlights her meritocratic skepticism of democratic politics. She writes that she, quote, regretted that our administration had not ascertained whether or not we had the votes before the president announced he was going to Congress. Had he known he would fail, she did not believe he would have chosen the path he did.
Right. So the question or the issue that's really important there is that essentially Power is saying that she doesn't think there should be real public debates about American foreign policy choices. And this has been a theme of the American foreign policy establishment since it was created in its modern instantiation after World War II. And as we've talked about before on the Michael Brooks Show, great show, everyone should listen, is that the institutions of American foreign policy, like the NSC, like the DOD, like the CIA, were specifically created. One of the many reasons they were created, but an important reason, was to ensure that ordinary Americans weren't actually able to influence American foreign policy and basically the policies of the empire. And so, though no one would say today, Samantha Power, I'm sure, would never say that she's anti-democratic. I'm sure she's a member of the hashtag of resistance, for that matter. You could see through quotes like that, that she very much is skeptical of ordinary Americans' ability to make decisions about what the United States should do in the world. Now, of course, the bitter irony is that people like Power are sending other people's children off to war to get traumatized, to get injured, and in some instances to even get killed, while, of course, she and her family and her friends and her social group suffer absolutely no consequences.
They lean on each other.
For someone who's concerned, they lean on each other. So for right. someone who's concerned about morality, it's a pretty glaring lacuna, in my opinion.
Absolutely. And in addition to that, you also say, meanwhile, I'm quoting you again, meanwhile, Power completely ignores the human rights violations that took place in her own country under Obama's watch. Like many liberal internationalists, she's far more vexed about suffering abroad. Nowhere does she address police violence against African Americans, mass surveillance, refugee detention, or mass incarceration. Nor does she give much thought to the colonial violence that defines American history. And you say in the education of idealist, she recalls inviting a Serbian official to meet with her in the so-called Indian room, where she lectured him on the importance of apprehending war criminal Ratko Mladic. Somehow, Power overlooks the irony of championing justice in a room named for repeatedly breaking treaties that the U.S. government made with the native population against which it committed genocide. I just wanted to quote that in full because I think that really, and we'll, as you respond to that, we now have the photo of Powers and Kissinger, who, I mean, if we can acknowledge that in reality, unwittingly, but in reality, she certainly has blood on her hands from, Libya as an example. Henry Kissinger, I think, is quite comfortable with the blood on his entire body, soaking himself from his entire career.
Yeah, I mean, he's someone who's truly bathed in blood. And I think the reason that I highlighted that is not to do a gotcha on Power, right? But it's just to say, if you're writing a 500-plus page memoir, it might even be 600 pages, I don't know, it seems like you would at least want to address the fact that, like you said before, drone strikes increased under Obama, or the fact of, warrantless surveillance or targeted assassinations or mass incarceration of an enormous number of the American poor and African Americans in particular. And it just seems like such a glaring instance. And this is what's important about that, is that the world that she claims that she wants to build, which is a world of human rights, which we all, I think, should want to build, will never be built if you don't take account of your own hypocrisies and your own blind spots. And particularly the thing that was just so glaring to me is, because she's a foreign policy person, is how do you not mention Saudi Arabia and Israel?
Right.
You know, how do you not mention Obama in 2015 ramping up the Saudi war in Yemen?
Right.
You know, I mean, this is such a glaring glaring gap. It really does undermine the entire project, because then you start asking yourself whether she's a morally or intellectually serious person, you know. And I think this is why I think the New Yorker Review got at it well. It's like, I think this is an audition for Secretary of State, and this is why the New York Times gave Tom Friedman the review of this book as opposed to someone who was going to evaluate it more seriously.
Right.
And I think
right.
And so it's a problem with the whole establishment.
Do you think there's a really disturbing incident that I think took place in 2015, I want to say, maybe even 2016, towards the end of the Obama administration.
Yeah, I think April 2016.
April 2016, Samantha Power. And this is just this just really depressing, horrible incident, which obviously, I mean, I've seen footage, actually. I forget that. I don't recall the name, but there's a documentary sort of tracking Power. You know, she obviously wasn't happy about this event, so that's not the point. But this event in Cameroon, which is such a kind of perfect micro case study of this imperialist, interventionalist kind of moral self-importance and its actual consequences on the ground. Can you tell us what happened?
Sure. So basically, everyone remembers Boko Haram. It had moved out of Nigeria and into several countries like Cameroon. So Power was going to one of the big things that she highlights in her book is that she would go around the world and really try to, you know, meet with people on the ground and see what they were experiencing. So in one of these instances, she goes with her 12-car convoy or whatever it is to Cameroon to visit a refugee camp of people who had fled Boko Haram. And on the way to the camp, her convoy, not the car she was in, but one of the cars, one of the armored cars, basically crushed the head of a young boy. I believe he was 7, named Toussaint. And basically he killed him. And there was like a horrible outcry, obviously, because this boy wouldn't have perished if Power hadn't been there. And she, I guess to her credit, if that's what you want to say, she admits as much in the book. But the thing is, and that's what's particularly disturbing to me, is that she doesn't take the opportunity to reflect on what this almost too perfect metaphor for what humanitarian intervention winds up doing, which is good intentions wind up having innocent people die. And this isn't just sometimes or even 1 in 2 instances or 1 in 3 instances. It's basically 10 out of 10 times humanitarian intervention over time results in more destabilization, more arming of local groups, more violence, more death, more destruction, more rape in the medium and long terms. And it's never something that she discusses, which is a shame, because this incident, I think, should have really forced a reconsideration of everything that she thought she was doing with U.S. military power in the world.
Absolutely. I mean, no, there's nothing. It's just such a depressing, such a perfect encapsulation of all of the dynamics here and all of the arrogance and all of the incredible human cost, even for, you know, the people that certainly the powers of the world would obviously, and I will say their immense arrogance, think they are acting on behalf. Final question. We've talked about this before. Because your work is a great synthesis of reworking the intellectual models that people use when they think about foreign policy, and then actually meeting with and dismantling the actual bureaucracy that has concentrated so much foreign policy making, the executive branch, and, you know, the sort of day to day running of let's say the military industrial complex. In the past couple of months, Sanders certainly, he's called for freeing Lula, which I think is usually innately important, but is also a stand-in for a willingness to buck U.S. foreign policy in a pretty significant way on behalf of an independent and thoughtful center-left leader who defied U.S. interests abroad. He's talked about cutting military spending. He's has a Green New Deal, which seems to provide a model of cooperating with places like China and Russia in a way that actually deals with solving the most serious collective problem we face. Do you think Sanders is putting actual points on the board here in terms of rethinking some of these things and putting new ideas forward?
I really do. And I think that has a lot to do with Matt Duss. Actually, Duss was quoted in an Atlantic article today where he basically said the one thing that we know for sure is we want to ramp down and eventually get out of the Middle East. We know that for sure. And we want to cut down military spending, and we want to work with Russia and China on climate. But the most important thing that he said to me was that basically everything else is on the table. And I think that's what's most important. And I want to emphasize, I and no one really writing right now has all the answers. But now is as a time for intellectual discussion, debate, and ferment, because we really haven't had one in the last 30 years. And to some degree, we really haven't had one in the last 70 years, rethinking America's global role and whether, quote unquote, American leadership, i.e. American empire, is something that's actually good for most Americans, or let alone most people in the world. So I think Bernie has been putting up, I think, significant points with everything you just said, but really importantly has shown that he's open to listening to new voices and also just rethinking some of the intellectual premises that he spent his life growing up with him.
Daniel Bessner, as always, much appreciated. The piece is The Fog of Intervention. It's in the New Republic. Daniel Bessner, thank you so much.
Thanks, Michael. Take it easy, man.
Take care, man. All right, folks, definitely read that Bessner piece. It's important. And that there's some HBO documentary where they're just flying around with power. It's pretty dull, frankly. And then out of nowhere, there's this event. There's this killing of this kid in Cameroon. And, you know, I mean, look. Power obviously is affected by it. She's not happy about it, but it's such a the arrogance of the whole policy set and even being there to begin with in some respects. And then the fact that, you know, of course there wasn't like, hey, maybe we should be slow, and this armored convoy were blaring through this area in a place where there aren't many cars and kids are out playing. The incredible arrogance and human cost of that really distills so much. And I want to tell you about Hunt a Killer. Hunt a Killer is the murder box that immerses you in an ongoing experience. With an everyday delivery or episode, you will dive deeper into what it's like to be a detective, shifting through piles of documents, evidence, and case files until you crack the case. Right now, just for our listeners, you can go to huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off of your first box. They only accept 200 members a day, so hurry up, take advantage of this offer. That's huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off your first box, huntakiller.com/majority. On Tuesday's Michael Brooks Show, we talked with Kianga Yamada Taylor about From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation, reform versus revolution, why that's a very unhelpful dichotomy and how that relates to really understanding the unparalleled significance and the importance of the Bernie Sanders campaign. Bhaskar Sunkara, Napoleon the Legend, and I, we talked about Christopher Hitchens. We talked about the Comoros Islands and French imperialism, commentary on West Papua, and reflected on the Broad Front coalition elections in Uruguay, plus a ton more. Some of which you can get a flavor of by watching our clips on the Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Check it out. But of course, the best thing to do is to go to patreon.com/TMBS, where you will also get This Sunday with Bill Fletcher Jr., an illicit history of a Robert Mugabe and modern Zimbabwe. Patreon.com/TMBS, Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Jamie, what's going on?
This week on the Antifada, we have on our friend Sophie St. Thomas, who is a sex and weed journalist, to talk about my trip to LA, hurricane sex, pickup artist magic, octopus weed, relationship boredigism, and Alexandra Kollontai's seminal essay, Make Way for Winged Eros. We also have a bonus with more Sophie St. Thomas coming out on Friday. And next week, I'm very, very excited to announce that we have on Aaron Bastani from Novara Media to talk about his awesome new book, Fully Automated Luxury Communism.
Speaking of Eros, did you guys talk about Dennis Prager's on visual stimulation yesterday?
We did not.
Oh, maybe we'll do that for
Seems
the fun
like enough. An oversight on our part, really.
Jesus Christ.
Hello.
For a literary hangover, I did part two of James Fenimore Cooper's The Pioneers, which is the first in his series on Natty Bumppo, and sort of, I don't know, maybe one of the earliest, he was the first guy who really made a living writing fiction in America, and that was basically not the first book he like got successful on, but the first giant series, and he did many sequels on it in true American fashion. So check that out, folks.
Awesome. All right, everybody. It's going to be a short, fun half. So, we'll see. We'll see what we get to, but we will see you there. Of course, become a member of the Majority Report. And tonight at about 7:40, we will start streaming the
Bates.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabs.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
This guy might be a Nazi.
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands
up.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.